You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking American League East with MLB.com's AL East beat reporters. Talking Orioles and taking a look at Manny Machado's breakout and Jonathan Scope and Kevin Gausman. We'll talk Yankees. We'll be taking a look at Michael Pineda's inconsistent year, Mark Teixeira, and the rotation. We talk Red Sox. We'll be taking a look at Mike Napoli, Eduardo Rodriguez, and Pablo Sandoval. With the Rays, we'll be talking some big picture, what kind of trade options they might have, the returns of Jake Odorizzi and Matt Moore. And when we talk Blue Jays, we'll be taking a look at the ninth inning shakeup and some other bullpen considerations, as well as talking about the return of Devin Travis.
Bill, the Rays, quietly, which is how they seem to do everything, are at least a candidate for the best story in baseball this year. This team went through massive overhaul starting from the deadline last year and over the winter, has gotten hit by injuries as hard as nearly any team in baseball, and they lead a division that I think is unfairly maligned. There's no great team in the AL East, but there's not a lot of lousiness in there either. It's a tough series pretty much every time in the AL East. So I want to start with kind of a big picture thing, and we've talked some about this, but I kind of want to explore it a little more. We get closer and closer to the non-waiver trade deadline. It's 5 weeks from tomorrow, if my math is right, and I'm pretty sure it is. We're late enough into the season where this team has not just had a hot couple of weeks, but barring something really surprising, they're very much in it. How do they approach the deadline, knowing full well that the Rays operate differently than nearly anybody else in baseball, and they're virtually never in a neat buy or sell box? Understanding that, how do they approach this opportunity that they've created for themselves where they're very much in contention for a postseason spot?
I think that's a very good question because they are unusual in that respect. In the past, one of the things they've always harped on was getting guys back as almost like their trade deadline goodie, and they will be getting back Odorizzi, and they will be getting back Matt Moore in the coming weeks. So I think that's their help on the pitching front. They might be looking for maybe a bullpen piece. They've done that some in the past. But as far as any big boom for the lineup, I just don't see it out there, and I don't see them making that big play. They signed Grady Sizemore. That might be the one guy that they're looking for to get a little bit of extra help. And it is marginal what you would expect Sizemore to give them if he does come up. So the only thing I think you can sell definitely is I don't think they're going to be sellers. So I think we can cross that one off. But I don't look for them to be big buyers either, unless it's a niche piece.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's been a pretty good offense, despite, again, some losses on the offensive side too. They do without Jennings. They do without Loney. Even with the guys they brought back, they're still missing some pieces. Are there small fixes they could make? You mentioned a reliever. Are there small fixes they could make to the offensive side, a bench bat, or again, is that probably Sizemore and maybe that's it?
Well, I mean, I'm sure they will listen to everybody and see what's available. We don't know what's available, what teams are saying you might have this guy for that. And I should have mentioned Loney earlier too. That's like getting a new guy back too, and he should be back soon as well. I think there's probably maybe an undiscovered or a bat that we haven't heard of that could be available, but I don't see anything in their DNA from the past that's see them make a splash to make themselves better for the rest of the season. And of course, being 8 games over 500 with what they have is pretty amazing, like you said, particularly when you consider, I think they're hoping their payroll was something in the neighborhood of $72 million, and they are operating with guys, about $36 million that's missing. So a small payroll, but even reduced further by injuries.
It's unreal. And yet one thing, at least, has really not gone well on the field. We talked a lot over the winter and early in the year, and you said again and again, and you were right. I'm not criticizing you for this. You said again and again, there's almost no way Rene Rivera couldn't be an upgrade. Almost no matter what he does, there's almost no way he's not an upgrade. it's late June and he's hitting 160. And at some point, maybe he's really not an upgrade. So what I'm asking is, how long can they continue to carry this guy who's not just hitting poorly, but who's hitting not even like a pitcher?
Well, first off, I disagree with you on the upgrade part of that, because just on the, you know, the energy he brings and the hustle behind the plate and the defense he's had throwing guys out, I think it's been a major upgrade. I'm not sure people realize how far Molina had declined in that area. Pitchers love throwing to this guy. He's throwing guys out all the time. Calls a great game. I mean, you know, there's other reasons for why, you know, just about all the starters have been wiped out, and you're still got a good group there. I mean, and of course, Hickey's a big part of that. And also, you've got the old thing about, you know, when somebody goes down, somebody else gets a chance to step up. But I think if anybody on the team's statistics are deceiving, it would be Rivera's, because he is, I think, been a huge upgrade for them.
So that is not a position they would be looking for an upgrade, or even an offensive backup catcher or anything like that? As far as they're concerned, they're pretty good at catcher?
I think totally. And, I mean, they've always viewed it as a defensive position anyway. And, for years they used Molina, or for the past 2 years, and Molina was, you know, started infrequently. But, you know, the big thing they liked about him was framing pitches. But, you know, a lot of pitchers would, you know, secretly say out of the side of their mouth they, you know, they didn't really like the fact that he didn't exactly hustle after a foul ball, I mean, a fastball, or, you know, other players didn't like the way he jogged to first base. You know, you're not seeing any of that. So, you know, will Rivera's offense get straightened out? Who knows? I've seen him hit a lot of balls hard this year, but I would think that the 160 is probably, as far as his value, is very deceiving.
Well, that's why we have a beat writer on, to set people like me straight who are hundreds of miles away. It seems like they are, as you mentioned, close to getting some really big pieces back. Is Jake Odorizzi first? And if so, what exactly is his status?
Well, it's going to be I think it's probably going to be Matt Moore first, because Moore starts tomorrow night, and that'll be his second AAA start. And I think they're fairly confident that he can come back after that. In fact, after talking to him on Tuesday night, he said he went in and told him, you know, I'm ready. He threw 90 pitches the last time out. He said, if you guys need me, I'm ready. And then he said he went in there on Tuesday before he had his bullpen in between, and he said he could tell before he even went and started throwing that they'd already made up their mind that he was going to have to do one more in AAA before he gets going. And, you know, I talked to him a little bit about the competitive aspect of it, and that might be more where he's at now than just the physical part. And it's, you know, just getting mentally ready to compete again against, like you say, a tough, you know, an always tough game in the AL East. So, you know, and you can't simulate Major League Baseball at the AAA level. There's no possible way. They're just not the same hitters. They don't think a lot. They don't have the same skill set. But, you know, one more tune-up, and then we'll see where he's at. I would expect him maybe next time in the rotation to be there. Now, what he gives them, who knows? I mean, he's been throwing 90-plus pitches. Is that going to translate to 5 or 6 innings? You know, and is that going to be much of an improvement over what they've had? We'll have to wait and see on that. Odorizzi, I would expect to be back shortly after that as well. So they have a pleasant problem now, which is something they haven't had to deal with all year.
Yeah, and that leads me to the next thing I was going to ask is it cut and dried whose places those guys take? Is there some question? Is there maybe some way that, you know, they do what some teams have done this year and go to 6 for a little while? When those guys come back, how do they work them in?
Well, you've got to think that you're not going to mess with Chris Archer. You want to leave him on, you know, whatever he's doing. You don't want to interrupt that. Nate Karns, you know, this guy, he started the year vying for the number 5 spot and looking like the long shot, and then he's come along and he's really looked good. And yesterday, you know, he matched Estrada, you know, pitch for pitch, almost no hitter versus perfect game. Some of that is his, you know, he's coming along with a a changeup that's looking a lot better, and that's keeping him off his fastball a little bit. But I think anything after those two is probably fair game. I mean, and of course, Erasmo Ramirez might have gotten hurt at the right time. Who knows? You know, he's had a groin problem, had to leave that start in Cleveland. Don't know if he's going to be ready yet. He didn't do his bullpen on Tuesday like he was supposed to. They were hoping to use that day, you know, today's off day to kind of backload the rotation and let him have a few extra days before he really tried to stretch out. As he explained to me, he said the big thing is once you get on the mound and you're, you know, kind of hurdling yourself towards home, that's when you really get the stress on the groin. He says he doesn't even feel it right now, so he's hopeful that he's, you know, caught it. But I'm as interested as anybody to just see what they're going to do there because, it, you know, it's a tough call.
Brian, the first line of my notes is simple and to the point. It says, Pineda, what's up with him? And so I ask you, what is up with Michael Pineda?
It's a good question. You know, since he had that 16-strikeout game against the Orioles on Mother's Day, it's been pretty up and down. And of late, it's been more down than up for Pineda. It seems like his slider has been spotty at times, and I think that's what you saw in his most recent start. He just couldn't put guys away. And this is a guy who is a power pitcher, has strikeout stuff, and he had guys in two-strike counts and just could not get the strikeout that he needed. Actually did not record a strikeout. That's the first time he's done that since that Pine Tar game, which we all remember he was tossed in the second inning. So that's not a good sign for the Yankees for sure. They think it's something they can figure out, but it does raise the question about when they pushed him back three starts ago and gave him 10 days rest, was that really the best way to handle things? They say yes. They say that his health is the paramount concern, but is it really worth it if now he's suddenly not the same pitcher that he was because he had his rhythm interrupted? So he said he didn't allow it to bother him, but the results say differently.
One word that seemed to come up repeatedly in the coverage of the last start was that Pineda's slider was flat. I mean, you need everything. You've got to have stuff. You've got to locate. But it seems like location can come and go. When it's something like that, when a guy's bread and butter breaking ball isn't moving, that seems a little more worrisome to me from the outside. Does it read that way to you, or is it not exactly like that?
Well, it's not a good thing. I mean, when you can't snap off a slider like that, like he's got that hard biting action on that slider, and that's what makes it a bread and butter pitch for him. But when he's not doing that correctly, it's just spinning up there, and it's saying, hit me, hit me. So that's what you saw in his last outing. It's something that they're going to try to correct in the bullpen. But, you know, this brings me back to the whole layoff and having your rhythm interrupted because he was pitching pretty well. And so it made you scratch your head, and I understand that he's never been over 200 innings in his career, and they are concerned about that. He was on pace for 220, 230, something like that. And so they're going to need to scale him back, and they may need to do it again, but it's not ideal. It's not what you want to have to do to push a guy back when he's pitching well. And now he's got to get back in that good groove again.
One thing that's intriguing, just looking at the charts, is that his velocity has been going up this year, fairly steadily April, May, June, which would seem to be encouraging. Does that kind of jibe with what you're seeing with your eyeballs, or is that a surprising thing to hear?
I think that's an encouraging thing. I think that tells you he's healthy. That makes you happy, I guess, if you're the Yankees, that it's not a health concern. Because if you saw a sudden drop in velocity, that would be a red flag. I think this may be more of a mechanical, more of a touch thing, that he's just not in the right slot. You know, he's funny to read because when he's going well, he looks like he's gyrating on the mound and he looks very uncomfortable. I think CeCe Sabathia said recently, when he's going good, he looks even more uncomfortable. So they actually want to see him fidgeting out there and gyrating the way he does because that means things are going well. And we saw it earlier this year. His last three starts, two of them were bad. One was very good. So maybe he's due for a very good one.
Let's move to another guy that there are questions about. What's the status of Mark Teixeira right now?
Well, Teixeira's in the lineup. You know, this was a nagging neck injury, a stiffness. It apparently started during the Baltimore series. He was trying to play through it, and they eventually just said, all right, stop. He needs a couple of days to cool it off. He went and had an MRI and a cortisone injection, which you know, he is no stranger to. He's certainly been familiar with the MRI tube and getting injections, and that's no fun for him. But he's back in the lineup this afternoon, and, you know, the Yankees feel like he should be okay. It's not really something that is a long-term concern. Jordan had said that if Teixeira wasn't able to play in the series finale against the Phillies, then he would be concerned about a DL stint. But they waited on the lineup a little bit today, and he's in there. So, you know, they have their fingers crossed because Garrett Jones hit the ball pretty well in those couple games filling in, but they're a better team with Mark Teixeira in the lineup.
Is this something they'll expect? They expect they will have to continue to manage going forward, or is this something that once it's out, it should be gone at least for a good while?
In theory, it should be. The cortisone injection should do what it's supposed to do. Usually, it takes a couple days to cool things off, but I wouldn't be shocked if it's something that pops back up again. He said he didn't really know how he aggravated it. It could have been on a dive. It could have been anything. I mean, you and I have probably woken up with stiff necks, and we didn't do anything wrong. So it could be something as simple as just sleeping funny, or maybe he has to get some better pillows. But either way, I think the Yankees, they'll keep an eye on it. But as of right now, it's not something they think is going to bother him deeper into the year.
As we talk, just now got the official acknowledgement that Ivan Nova has been activated. That's not a surprise. We knew it was coming. To me, what's interesting is that for now, they're not bumping anybody. They're going to go maybe a couple times through the rotation with six guys. They're saying it's just really a short-term thing, perhaps having learned from what a miserable time Terry Collins had when he said we have a six-man rotation. But I know we've talked about this a lot, but now that it's actually here, what do they do with the rotation, both over these next couple of weeks and after that?
I think TBA is your answer. You know, six-man rotations are messy. People like being on that regular rest. They don't like the extra day in there. And the Yankees have a little bit of a question mark here because, all right, you know that Michael Pineda is going to be in the rotation. You know that Masahiro Tanaka is going to be in the rotation. CeCe Sabathia's contract says he should be in the rotation. Now, performance aside, maybe you can talk about the fact that maybe Sabathia should be the one who gets bumped here, but we'll continue on that. Girardi was asked that point blank last night, said absolutely not. He is going to be in the rotation. He's going to start. He's got to figure it out. So now that gets us back to Nathan Eovaldi, who the Yankees want to develop as a starter. They see high-end talent there. Those starts are valuable for him. He's not going to get any better pitching in the bullpen. And now Nova's going to be in the rotation, and that brings us back around to Adam Warren. I'm sorry, it's not fair. I know Warren would prefer to be in the rotation, but he's excelled in the bullpen, and I don't know if you've been paying attention, but the Yankees have some bullpen problems right now, too. They've had a revolving door there. So I think if I were the Yankees, I'd tell Adam Warren, I'm sorry, I know you didn't do anything to deserve this, but you've got to go to the bullpen. We need you back there more than we need you in the rotation right now. We've got a wealth of starting pitchers, and we need you to go put out some fires in the bullpen.
This may actually be what they're doing, but is it possible to kind of use Warren as a true swingman? And if you want to keep people on turn and want to also make sure that you don't push them, go to a six-day rotation. And when there are a bunch of days in a row, Warren gets a start. When you've got off days, you stay on a five-man. But you say, look, you're pitching every sixth day. Do your routine to that and something like that. Or is that still too woo crazy for baseball in 2015?
I wouldn't rule it out, and here's why. Larry Rothschild, the pitching coach, brought this idea up last year when the Tanaka came back, and they also knew about Pineda missing most of the season. I think that you're looking now. CeCe Sabathia is obviously not the kind of guy you can count on to be a workhorse. He's certainly not going 8-9 innings like he used to. He could use a break. Tanaka can use a break because you've got that elbow ligament that you're still cautious about. Pineda, as we've previously discussed, they're concerned about his inning totals. So I think there's a lot of reasons a six-man rotation could work for the Yankees. I think that, yeah, I mean, you're right. It is a new age thing, and teams have been trying it with some success, but not always swimmingly. I think for this team, it's something that could work here. It's something that they're certainly kicking around. I'm just not sure how it's going to fit out. But as Girardi keeps saying, these things tend to work themselves out. So we could talk until we're blue in the face about a six-man rotation. If somebody pulls a hamstring or walks off the mound holding their elbow, I think that answers your question pretty quickly.
And one last thing I wanted to ask you before we go is about Aaron Judge, who just got moved up one more level. The raw power this guy has is I don't know if it's 80 power, but It's certainly 80 hit one ball a long way power. How does he figure into the picture here, especially for a team where, I know they're paying Carlos Beltran, but I also know that Carlos Beltran hasn't exactly been what they've hoped for, and if he were to get there, it seems like there might be an opportunity to give him at bats if they wanted to.
Yeah, Beltran's actually been playing better. I know he got off to a slow start, and that colors his numbers a bit, but Judge is legit. I mean, we saw him in spring training. This guy, I talked to scouts, and two of the names that they brought up were Giancarlo Stanton and Dave Winfield. I mean, come on. Those are ridiculous comparisons.
And that's completely fair.
Yeah, you're setting the bar pretty high. But if he's even a fraction of what those two players are, the Yankees are in pretty good shape. So this kid is the future. You're going to see him in the Bronx at some point as long as they hang on to him and he stays healthy. He draws your attention when he's on the field. He's big. He's tall. He's just a powerful presence. You can see this guy hitting in the middle of a major league lineup in the very near future. I'm not sure what that means for 2015, but I see a real scenario where he could come into camp and just force their hand next year in spring training and be in right field on opening day.
Britt, it's a topic I've had on my list for a couple of weeks here, and I think maybe even 3 weeks ago didn't get to with you and didn't get to with Jim Hunter. And conveniently, it remains a really good topic because Manny Machado continues to absolutely rake. It seems like quietly, oddly, given the amount of hype he got earlier in his career, quietly he has really kind of made the leap offensively. And so I wonder first just what you're seeing from him when you watch him at the plate in 2015.
I was talking to the hitting coach, Scott Colwell, yesterday, and it seems like he is being more patient, hitting all parts of the park, and he's kind of developing a little bit more into that power guy. I mean, he's still so young. 22, 23 years old, and I think you expected that those doubles that he hit a few years ago would become home runs, and that's what's happening now. So I think he likes the leadoff role. He's taken to it. He's done a nice job, and he's just kind of evolving the way people thought. He had those injuries, and people kind of forgot about him. Like you said, it's a little bit quieter this year, but having a really nice year.
One of the things, and you did just touch on this, that really stands out, he had in the minors a pretty good strike zone, and then his first couple years in the majors, that ratio was not good. He struck out, not excessively, but a lot, and didn't walk much. This year he's really walking a lot more, not to the point where it's he's looking to walk, but it seems like he's kind of found that strike zone he had in the minors. Is that a conscious decision, or is that just a guy kind of improving pitch recognition, feeling more comfortable, just kind of developing as a hitter?
I don't know if it's a conscious decision. I think you'd have to ask him that. I can't speak for him in terms of that, but I think he's evolving a little bit. He's maturing a little bit, and you're starting to see a player who's kind of coming into their own. He had injuries, like I mentioned. He had periods where he really struggled at the plate, and now he's kind of figuring out who he is as a hitter and who he is as a player a little bit more. That's, I think, what you're seeing this year.
You had mentioned earlier in the year that he was having some defensive struggles, and it kind of, to some extent, went unnoticed because he's been such a good defensive player. How has he looked defensively in recent weeks?
Better. He's, I think, trying to be a little less flashy. And early on, I think a lot of those plays could have been made if he wasn't trying to kind of make them look a little flashier. He's simplified things. Having J.J. Hardy next to him, who's such a simple guy who makes really tough plays look easy, certainly goes a long way and helps in that regard. But I think he's getting better. Offensively, this is definitely a better year than defensively for him. I don't think he's a guy who jumps out at you as winning a Platinum Gold Glove again. I do believe he's at the top of the team in error still. And, part of that is getting off, like we mentioned, to a really rocky start defensively. But he has been better lately, and obviously that's huge for the Orioles. Such a big cornerstone of what they do is defense.
One thing that jumps out, and you've naturally mentioned health a couple of times already in these couple of minutes, and he is obviously finally healthy, it seems. One thing that really seems to reflect that, he's got more steals this year than in the entire rest of his career combined. Is that something that should continue to be in his game? Maybe not, not a 30 or 40 guy, but a guy who might steal 15, 20 bags a year?
Yeah, I think so. Again, like you said, he's not going to be a huge speed guy all the time, but I think it just shows how good he's feeling, how good his legs are feeling. And we saw that dating back to spring training. We talked a lot about the fact that he was running a lot more on the base paths in the Grapefruit League. So definitely a really good sign.
The other guy who's obviously a key core to this lineup, Adam Jones, they've been doing without a lot lately, with the acknowledgement that this really is as day-to-day as injuries can be. It really is every day what's the story. Right now, as we talk, where does Adam Jones' injury situation stand?
Well, he's not on the lineup again tonight, and they're finally starting to say that potentially he could be a DL. He's not going to be DL tonight, so he's not going to be the move that they're still waiting on, which is the move that they need to activate tonight, starter Wei-Yin Chen. But he could potentially, if he's not ready by this weekend, be the move that brings infielder Jonathan Scope back from rehab. He's been at AA Bowie, and they feel like he can come and help the team soon. So you're getting to the point now with Adam where they probably should have, when it first crept up, just DL'd him and really just gotten it out. But instead, they let him rest a few days. They put him in as DH in Toronto. I think that hurt him a lot. And now you're talking about a guy who hasn't played in almost a week, and this Orioles team just can't go short for that long. So I would expect a resolution within the next day or two when it comes to him, whether it's DL or whether it's he's ready to get back in there and start playing.
Is the expectation, regardless, that even if they DL him, we're not looking at a long-term thing? It's get him that remaining week and a half to get right?
Right. There's nothing structurally wrong with his shoulder. So they've been trying to avoid it, but, again, they might just need the roster spot.
It's weird to say when the face of the franchise is ailing, but aside from Jones, it seems like this team is pretty close to as whole and as healthy as it's been all year. Are they kind of getting that feeling in the clubhouse that, hey, maybe some things are starting to turn our way?
A little bit. You know, they've won, I think, six or seven straight series, so they're starting to play better, certainly 15 of 20 going into tonight, so I think getting Matt Wieters back was big. It's no coincidence they went on this run right when they got him back. And you mentioned about the Jones is out, and you know they haven't really pitched all that well either, but somehow they've managed to keep winning. And guys like Manny Machado really helped them, and you know they're getting some good relief outings out of their bullpen closers. Zach Britton has been fantastic. So they've been able to piece it together. So I think they are kind of becoming more of the team everybody thought they were going to be, but they still have a ways to go.
You mentioned Jonathan Scope. How close is he to being back?
He could be back tonight if they had an injury / a roster spot that they could actually move around for him. Honestly, I mean, he's been really good. He was in Baltimore today. He's playing a Bowie again tonight, and you know, he's ready. He's ready to return. But like I said, they have a lot of unauctionable pieces, which has really made it difficult for them to maneuver around the roster, and that's why they're going to wait a few more days on Scope, see if something presents itself, whether it's Adam Jones or something else.
They've gotten pretty nice production in his absence, and I get the impression they like Flaherty quite a bit. When Scope comes back, does he step right into being the everyday second baseman, or is there any kind of a job share there?
No, he'll become the everyday second baseman. They like Flaherty as their utility guy, but when you look at the bottom of the order, Flaherty's not a guy you expect to go deep. Jonathan Scope was having a really nice second season offensively, and they're, in my opinion, they miss his stat a lot. I mean, he's a guy who you can slot in eighth or ninth and really has the potential to hurt you. So he really makes their lineup a lot stronger. I don't think there's any question that he'll be at second base when he is fully ready and deemed ready to come back.
And then one last thing, something you addressed in your inbox this week. Kevin Gausman came up, pitched pretty well. What is the plan for him going forward? Now that the rotation is apparently fully healthy again, does it sort of resume that holding pattern where he goes down to AAA and starts and is ready at a moment's notice, or what's the kind of plan for him going forward?
Pretty much. I mean, they just didn't have any other options. He had to be the guy to go. They can't option any of their other starters the way it's set up right now. So, yes, they want him to be on a consistent schedule. Yes, they'd like him to be part of their rotation now, but as I alluded to, they don't have any roster flexibility. So they felt like putting him in Norfolk, kind of making sure his innings are up, because he's only had 12 innings in the major leagues this year. So they want to make sure that he pitches more than 80 or 90 innings this year. So they'll be able to do it a little bit better in Norfolk when winning can sometimes become secondary to guys' development. So they feel like this was the best move for them. But he's going to be a short phone call away. I mean, the second they need a starter, they've got Tyler Wilson, they've got Mike Wright, they got Gausman down there. So they feel pretty good about their pitching depth and where it is.
Is a healthy and stretched out Gausman a clear first choice if they need a starter, or has that depth chart been jumbled at all based on how some of these guys have done as they've come up?
I think it's a little closer than people think, Matthew. I think that Tyler Wilson and Mike Wright have certainly made a really nice impression, and when they look at it, I think a lot of it's just going to come down to whose turn it is. When you look at those guys and they look down to Norfolk because they need a starter, who's been rested, who's going to stay on turn, maybe who did best the last time out, because they really hold all three of those guys in high regard. All three of those guys have proven that they can pitch and pitch well in the major leagues.
Berger, once again, the Blue Jays have some upheaval in the ninth inning. Once again, Brett Cecil is out. Once again, it seems unclear what exactly they're going to do in the interim. How do you think this goes, first of all, in the short term? How are they going to handle this?
Yeah, and the short term is the one to be concerned about for sure, because I think it's probably inevitable that this team eventually does make a move before the deadline. But, you know, it's going to be a little while before that happens. So, I think this is really a situation where you're going to see a bit of a closer by committee approach, and that's something that John Gibbons, the manager, doesn't really like to do. But it's kind of a situation he's been forced into right now. And that's really because, you know, the only reliable guy that they've had down there consistently day to day has been Roberto Osuna. And he's just been so valuable in a middle relief setup type role as well, that they can't really afford to completely lose him in that role. There are going to be times when he's needed to come in the seventh or eighth inning and do the job then. You might see some situations as well where he gets some two inning saves and then won't be available the next day. So I think it's going to be a mixture between Osuna and Steve Delabar. I think Osuna will get the majority of the chances. But this is a situation right now where the Blue Jays don't really have an official closer. They're going to try and piece some things together here over the next few weeks.
So you've just kind of teed up one of my favorite topics here. And it's so weird when clubs get to this, when particularly a pretty traditional guy like John Gibbons gets to this point where he's acknowledging that this guy is so good that they may need him for situations other than the ninth inning, and yet they still build this closer-centric bullpen. Is there any, I mean, does it even occur to him, this sort of disconnect here? I guess what I'm asking is there any chance that the Blue Jays, because of this realization, get anywhere closer to a non-closer-centric bullpen where they say, hey, this guy's our best reliever, maybe we should use him at the biggest moment and just worry about the ninth in another way?
Yeah, and it's certainly an interesting topic, and one that, you know, that kind of goes back to the beginning of the season for the Jays, because, you know, going into this year, they didn't have that, you know, clear-cut veteran ninth-inning guy who you have to put in the ninth inning because that's the role that he's paid to do, and that's the one that he expects to have. They didn't have that going into this year, and, you know, even when Brett Cecil was going well, you could certainly make the case that there were times when he would have been needed in the seventh or eighth inning, and Roberto Osuna the same thing, and Miguel Castro before his struggles. So there were people lobbying for that approach from day one. The counter that Gibbons has is the one that, you know, a lot of traditional managers do have as well, which is he likes to have his guys in roles so that they have a better idea of what to expect. That's kind of why he doesn't like to have this, closer by committee approach, because it takes a little bit away from that uncertainty. So I think ideally he would like to get back to that, but with the personnel that the Jays have right now, it's just not really possible to do that either. And, you know, it could be a situation where the Blue Jays eventually do end up grabbing that, that ninth inning guy via trade before the deadline. But you could probably still easily make the case that no matter who that is that's coming in, Roberto Osuna might be a guy who, you know, has a bit better of a success rate than that person as well. So you could be in a situation where you are actually still using your better reliever when you need him in the seventh or eighth, as opposed to just strictly holding onto him for the ninth. But it is an interesting argument, and one that's probably not going to go away anytime soon, especially based on who the Jays have in the fold right now.
And this leads into another question. There's a lot tied up into here, because the Blue Jays are such an interesting team, because there's so many things going well and so many things simultaneously that could be better. And one of the things that has been talked about is regarding Aaron Sanchez. And for the moment, it appears that the rotation has kind of stabilized. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to expect Marco Estrada to continue taking no-hitters deep into games, but more or less, the rotation seems good enough right now. And so I know there's some thought. Are they getting closer to this idea that maybe at least in the short term, when Aaron Sanchez comes back, he goes to the bullpen and becomes a piece there?
I think that is a legitimate possibility, and it's something that, you know, it's been an ongoing conversation really through this entire year. Where is he best served? Do the Blue Jays need him more in the bullpen, or do they need him in the rotation? There was a long time where I thought Aaron Sanchez would probably be best suited in the bullpen to really help solidify things. My opinion did kind of change over that final month before he got hurt, and simply just because, to me, he was the Blue Jays' best starter for about a four-week span. You know, the walks were a huge concern early on in the year, but we saw a constant progression in that, and he really seemed to figure a lot of things out. The number of walks were going down with each start, and I just think that he's got the highest ceiling of anyone that they have in that rotation, and you kind of almost have to let that play out a little bit and see how he comes back from that injury. And they're not going to start him unless he's completely healthy and they think that the innings isn't going to be a concern for him. But if he can get over that hump over the next few weeks, you know, I think they almost, you know, have to just kind of put him back in that role and see if he's able to pick up where he left off. Now, if he has any kind of struggles in the rotation, then to me, a great fallback is then slotting him into that bullpen because, you know, this is a team that probably needs not just one guy down there, but they need a couple. So even if you're adding, you know, a bullpen arm before the deadline, you could easily make the case that they need someone else, and Sanchez could be that guy. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're talking about maybe you have a bona fide closer, and then you also have Osuna and Sanchez at your availability to go along with guys like Brett Cecil and Aaron Loop. And you're talking about a bullpen that's going from a major weakness into a possible strength, and it could be that easy. But to me, I think, you know, you can't necessarily count on Estrada to keep going at his current pace. So if you're going to replace Sanchez with somebody else in the rotation, then I think that means that the Jays have to go outside the organization to add that extra arm to take his spot in the rotation long term.
So where do they go to do that? Because, you know, part of the problem here, Francisco Rodriguez is a name that's come up a lot, but his contract is not very friendly. It's pretty heavily backloaded. Jonathan Papelbon probably has some significant commitment beyond this year as well. So these guys who are the obvious names, this club, and we've talked about this before, there is some question about how much of a additional, I should say, because there is significant financial commitment to this club, but how much of an additional financial commitment they are able and willing to make right now. So are those guys on the table? And if not, where else do they look to make those additions to a bullpen that needs help?
Yeah, and to me, Rodriguez probably makes the most sense because some of that money is deferred as well. So there is a huge commitment to him after this year. But I think just the way the Blue Jays are focusing right now, I think they're mostly concerned about the money that would be on the books for this season. And certainly Jonathan Papelbon still, even though you're talking about getting a guy midway through the year, he's still a pretty big commitment left on that dollar. And, you know, the Blue Jays do have a limited amount of money to spend, and they're looking to get a couple of pieces with that available cash, and they don't want to burn it all on one guy. I think it would be a disappointment for Anthopoulos if he came away from the deadline and all he got was a guy like Papelbon and nothing else. And so, you know, things can change with that. You know, Philadelphia, if they're willing to eat some money, then that kind of puts them into the mix as well. But the fact that, you know, Rodriguez does have a big figure owed after this year could work in their favor a little bit because the Blue Jays also do have a lot of money coming off the books. And while they backloaded some deals like Russell Martin, even though Jose Reyes' contract was heavily backloaded when he signed that in Miami, there is some flexibility after this year. And so that could be one way of getting, you know, around the payroll parameters that they have set in place for this year in order to try and make a run.
And then one other thing before we let you go, just want to talk about the other impending breaking news, I guess not breaking, the other immediate news regarding the Blue Jays, which is the return of Devin Travis. And look, you can make more mistakes looking at a week or two of stats than you can get things right, but Travis didn't really hit much on his minor league rehab assignment. Is there any level of concern about how he's going to perform upon his return, or do they just think, look, that happens, it's a small number of bats, don't worry about it?
I think there's a little bit of concern there, and I think that's why, you know, his rehab went a little bit longer than originally anticipated. I mean, originally they were talking about, you know, bringing him back towards the end of last week, and they really maximized the amount of time he could take on his rehab just because the timing wasn't there. And, I mean, this is a guy who missed an awful lot of time. So I think you have to, you know, hold your expectations in check just a little bit for him to kind of settle back into a bit of a routine. And certainly, you know, while the numbers weren't there in the minors, you can't really expect him to be there in the majors right off the bat as well. You know, he's also coming into a situation, it's a little bit tough for him because now the expectations overall from the fan base and probably from his teammates as well are higher than they were going into this year. I mean, this isn't someone who, you know, was supposed to provide that much value with the bat as he did in April. He was, you know, arguably the team's best hitter for a long stretch of time outside of Josh Donaldson. So, you know, but he's an upgrade over Ryan Goins. Ryan Goins did a solid job while filling in, but he's mostly a glove-first type guy. So really, no matter what kind of production you're going to get out of Travis, it should be better than what they got out of Goins. And the fact that you're now adding a piece to a lineup that's already been the best in baseball for a long stretch now is good news overall for the team.
Ian, what can they do about this first base situation? I mean, I guess the first question is Mike Napoli, is this really bad? Is he approaching done, or is this a really long slump for a guy who's had really long slumps before?
Yeah, it's a really long slump. I think he's in his own head. And to me, for a guy who was the American League Player of the Week, it was, a month ago now? If he hit 5 home runs in a week a month ago, it's hard for me to think that the guy is washed up at 33 years old or whatever he is. I just think that he's gotten into some extremely bad habits at the plate, and for whatever reason, the slumps have gone on longer than usual. But, you know, if it wasn't for that 5 homers in a week a month ago, maybe we would think he's done. But, you know, you don't lose it that fast, you know, especially at that age. The guy's not – it's not like he's in his late 30s. He's still – early 30s. So, you know, I think he still has some baseball in him, and for whatever reason, he's just having, you know, a really bad season. I remember Mike Lowell had a season like this for the Marlins in 2005 where everyone thought he was completely done, and then he came to the Red Sox and had some really good years.
So while they're waiting for him to get sorted out, yeah, what exactly can they do? Because this is not a team that's in a position to be carrying guys who aren't performing. They're not in good enough shape, and they're not playing well enough to be looking to upgrade at positions where guys are really struggling.
No, I mean, you make a good point. And the one thing the Red Sox can do right now, and I'm sure they will do this tonight, is, you know, you can put Brock Holt at first base against tough righties. You know, Mike is, for example, Bud Norris is a guy who Mike Napoli has struggled against in his career. So you can put a Holt in there, and that's where, you know, if Holt's going to be playing some more first, then you need some more help in right field. You know, a left-handed bat in right field. You have Diaza. You have Bradley, who's doing really well at AAA. And the only reason I can think of why they're not bringing Bradley up is because they're planning on him packaging him in a trade by July 31st, and they'd rather trade those gaudy AAA numbers he has right now rather than bring him up to the majors and watch him hit .210 again. So, and then you have Shane Victorino, who, you know, Shane Victorino comeback point, you know, 5.0 or whatever it is now. Shane's going out on a rehab this weekend. Hopefully, he did provide a little spark the last time he came back. Unfortunately, it was short-lived. So you do have some options, and you also have Alan Craig who could play first base down at Pawtucket. So there's a whole lot of things they could do internally. This isn't something they necessarily have to make a trade for to address. They can address this in-house, and I think that, you know, in the coming days they're going to try to figure out a way to do that.
Well, bless you. You just set me up. I hadn't asked about him in a few weeks, so we're in a position where now I kind of have to. The wrench, Alan Craig, is putting up decent numbers. Now, it's up and down. He's not obliterating the ball, but he is getting on base. He's been decent down there, and I think he's at least a passable defensive first baseman. Has he hit enough to where he's back in the picture, to where he's at least an option again when they look at what they've got there?
Yeah, I think Craig is working his way into the mix. I mean, how could he not? I mean, this guy is, he's hit for most of his career, and he's another guy. You really lose it that fast. So, he's a guy who could resurface. I think that they want to exhaust every chance to get Napoli going here, because not only is Napoli a huge, part of the fabric in that clubhouse, you know, a glue guy, so to speak, but they really like his defense at first base. And, you know, his hot streak, they're almost worth waiting for sometimes, because he can sort of carry a team. You know, he carried a team for a week this year, but he's a guy who's carried a team for 2-3 weeks in the past, been a big-game player throughout his career. So I think they're going to give it every chance before they flat-out pull the plug. But, you know what time of year it is, Matthew. It's late June. Teams are going to have to start making definitive decisions. July is really when you make a decision about the kind of team you're going to have for the rest of the season. So these are all internal discussions the Red Sox are having on a daily basis.
To continue bouncing around a little bit, Eduardo Rodriguez, we knew he had really good stuff, and he did have one clunker, but it is not supposed to be as easy to make this transition as he has made it. What is it that has allowed him to translate what everybody knows is a big arm into being so far a really good major league starting pitcher?
Yeah, you know, I think everybody knew about the stuff that Eduardo Rodriguez had, but I think the poise was a little bit underrated. And going around and talking to different guys in the clubhouse, you know, whether it's Clay Buchholz or whether it's pitching coach Carl Willis, the thing that really impresses Deb about Eduardo is that he does not get unnerved. Even that game he struggled against Toronto. Now, mind you, that game against Toronto, he was facing a buzzsaw with that team. They were just in the, one of those zones. And, you know, he also had three or four drop pop-ups by other guys that game. So that was even one of those games that didn't look as bad as it was. But, yeah, just the composure he has for a 22-year-old kid, pretty impressive. So they're really quietly very excited about this kid. They think they might have a guy who can be a one- or two-starter for several years to come, and they just hope that he can sort of keep this role going right here.
I know they were really excited about him when they got him, and some people at the time said he was the best pitching prospect to change hands at the deadline, but even so, as good as Andrew Miller is and as good as Andrew Miller was for the Orioles after the deal, I don't think if they knew they were giving up a guy who's been this good, they maybe would have given him up for 20 innings of a left-handed reliever. So all of that is a long way of prefacing question. Did the Red Sox see something the Orioles didn't? Were the Orioles just that dead set that they had to have Andrew Miller no matter what? How did they get this guy who is not only this good, but right away? You know, it's not like they got a guy who was 4 years away and sort of turned into something over time. They got a guy who was right there and is very good right now. How did that happen that they get this kind of value for 20 innings of admittedly a great left-handed reliever?
I mean, from a Red Sox perspective, this was a no-brainer because they were 15 games out or whatever they were at the time. Miller was going to be a free agent. They knew they were going to try and bring Miller back, whether he would spend the rest of the year with the team or not. So they figured, why not trade him? And Andrew Miller was really a great chip for them last July. And the Red Sox balanced 5, 6, 7 offers around for Andrew Miller. And I think that's where it helped with the Orioles, because the Orioles were competing with a lot of other teams for Andrew Miller. They really wanted him, and the Red Sox got the pitching prospect they wanted. Now, you can question, you know, did Dan Duquette get a little too short-term oriented in making that trade? I mean, in fairness to Dan Duquette, he's trying to win a World Series last year, you know, and he didn't foresee perhaps some of the injuries that his Orioles team was going to have down the stretch last year, where maybe that team would have won the whole thing last year if they didn't, you know, have so many injuries they had. So, you know, I think it was a decent baseball move. And, you know, the Red Sox were on, you know, the infamous Larry Anderson-Jeff Bagwell trade. It was sort of a similar thing in 1990 with it. You know, they're trying to win a division in a World Series, and they trade a future star for, you know, a guy who gives them 2 months of relief. So very, very kind of parallel there. But, yeah, I mean, easy to second-guess that trade from a Baltimore standpoint. But the Red Sox were very high on Eduardo Rodriguez all along.
And then one other thing, and the note, the line in my note says, Pablo and Instagram. Really? And, I mean, essentially that's my question. Look, I know that this is not only a Red Sox rule, but a Major League rule, but is there anywhere other than Boston and maybe New York where this becomes the level of story? I mean, is this as silly as it seems from outside?
No, I just think that, you know, it's one of those, like you say, it's a Boston-New York thing. We have all kinds of bloggers around here are monitoring players' Instagrams and what time they're sending things out. And just, you know, the way that came out, nobody would have ever known about this if it wasn't for, you know, like I said, a blogger posted, oh, this is interesting that this person posted this thing during the game. I would think, Matthew, you know, players are going into the clubhouse all the time. And, you know, I would think guys check their phones. That was kind of stupid of him to push the like button. And I think it was just kind of one of those, we've all said or done stupid things in the spur of the moment that once you do it, you're like, oh, I wish I could take that back. And I think that's all that this was. And I think that John Farrell had been under a lot of heat because people thought maybe he should have been harder on Wade Miley for that situation. They thought maybe he should have been harder on Hanley Ramirez for some of his mental mistakes he's made. So I think that the Red Sox felt they had, you know, the way the team was playing, they had no choice but to give Sandoval, you know, a benching that game, where maybe this is something that could have been handled a little bit differently. But yeah, definitely a controversy that probably got a little more, you know, attention than deserved.
And to follow on Sandoval, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like, am I right in saying that there is at least some level of at least within the perception, the public perception, media perception, and this is just a setup, so this is a yes or no, that he's been a disappointment with his performance overall this year?
Yeah, you could say that until he got, you know, he's gotten red hot here over the, you know, essentially since the Instagram thing. But, you know, look at his numbers at this time last year. I think he's been a second-half player at times. You know, like we talked about with Napoli, a streak player at times in his career. And, you know, I think that if anything, Sandoval's defense has been what's been disappointing. I think his offense is pretty much, you know, what you see is what you get. Some weeks he's going to be really hot. Other weeks he's going to be cold. But, yeah, defensively they like a little more concentration out of him. But, you know, other than that, I think the team is basically getting what they expect. Anytime a team spends that much money on a player, I think sometimes the fans and media might expect a little more. But I don't think that Pablo Sandoval is that different a player right now than he was, you know, all those years in San Francisco. I think there's just more attention on him because he's playing in Boston.
Well, yeah, that's really the answer to my follow-up, which was, do they not know this is what he is? I mean, he's
no,
had a couple of great Octobers,
Sox,
but
this
guy isn't a 320 hitter. He's a 270, 280 hitter with moderate power who doesn't strike out much and is a better third baseman or has been than he gets credit for. But was there an expectation that he would be more than that?
No, not from the team itself. Like I said, the team is getting what they expected from this guy. And, you know, media, fans, they see a guy sign for $95 million. They see a guy who's won three World Series. The only times a lot of these fans have watched Pablo Sandoval is in October when he's just, you know, last year he was terrific. So, you know, I think that fans sometimes don't look deep down inside the numbers at what this guy is a player. But no, like I said, the only complaint the Red Sox have had about Sandoval is they thought he'd be a little better on defense. He's made some sort of careless mistakes with the glove. And aside from that, the Red Sox are getting kind of what they expected from Sandoval. And it's just one of those things. The team isn't playing well, so there's more scrutiny on it right now.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening.